It's our custom after someone has been involved in a significant retreat experience to give that person a chance to think out loud about the experience. That helps them integrate what they learned. A great bit of what is a benefit during retreat is kind of zigzagging around in the subconscious. So when a person makes the effort to talk about it, that in a sense connects the dots in the brain, in the mind. And so it helps clarify the experience for that person. And then people ask them questions, which also facilitates that process. It also perhaps is informative and inspirational for those of us who have not been on the retreat. So Will, you, if I understand correctly, you have been on a series of retreats and kind of study processes about the Satipatthana with Analio. And I would hope that you would, if I'm correct, that you will review just sort of the general gist of what
Peter,
that
was
like. Huh?
You froze.
Froze. Well, I've got a full connection here. Can you hear me now?
I can hear you now, but I missed what you said. You said I last I heard was Satipatthana, and then I don't know what you said after that.
Well, just basically that there were a series of retreats and kind of study processes that you went through that were facilitated by Analio, and I would hope that you would kind of give an overall review of that process. You know, this happened, then this happened, then this happened, this happened. And then talk about your most recent retreat experience, which was a self-retreat and supported by Analio and his crew. And then what the takeaway is from this experience for you. So floor is yours, my friend.
Great. Okay. Yeah. This last retreat, it was a 10-day retreat, and it was also my 10th total retreat I've ever done. I decided to do this one for the first time. I decided to do this one at home since I live alone. And just for a whole lot of reasons, it made a lot of sense to do this one at home. And this was the last retreat in a three series retreat that I did, in a three retreat series that I did with Analio, that I signed up for with Analio. And the first one was about a year ago, which was it was on the Satipatthana, translation, basically the way he practices it based on his translation. The second one was on the Anapanasati Sutta, which was another 10-day retreat, which he it was also based on his interpretation of it, his translation of the suttas, and kind of how he got to where he got with the practice. And then with this last one, it was on the Brahmaviharas and then into emptiness, all based on oldest suttas and even like the Chinese agamas.
Let me just insert that the Chinese agamas are versions of the suttas that were transmitted into China when Buddhism went to China several centuries after the time of the Buddha. So part of what Analio's study has been was to compare those two and figure out what they have in common.
Yeah. Yeah. And so with a lot of the Buddhist teachings, they're pretty new. You know, you guys all know, a lot of them are relatively, new, and they're based on, incomplete translations a lot of times. And so a lot of what you hear, a lot of what you get, and what's sold off as Theravada Buddhism a lot of times isn't really very authentic. And what Anallio has done is he's gone back and he's translated all sorts of different versions of these suttas, because it was all spoken word at the time of the Buddha, and it wasn't until several hundred years that it was actually put down on paper, or not even on paper, but it was actually put down. It was actually recorded, and by that time, Buddhism had traveled to different regions, and so it was in different languages and whatnot. And this is all his practice based on his research, and his mission is to try to get it to as close as to how the Buddha actually probably practiced. And he doesn't claim that what he does is how the Buddha practices, but he's trying to get there pretty close. And he definitely has a lot of practice, like meditation experience. I heard one time his meditation routine is 5 hours in the morning, 5 hours straight, and then he works for 8 hours, and then he meditates for another 5 hours, and then he sleeps for like maybe 4 hours or something like that. And that's his day every day. And so just to give you an idea of how much practice he has, he's about to start a 1-year silent retreat in August. So he has decades of experience, and then also he's brilliant. You know, he speaks several different languages, and so he's a scholar with a lot of meditation experience.
And he's actually German, but speaks fluent English.
Fluent a lot of languages. he speaks fluent Pali, I think, actually.
Let me interject also in there that what you were just talking about is based on 3 books that he's written. The Satipatthana. I actually wrote 2 books about the Satipatthana. One of them is a practice guide, and then a book on the Anapanasati, and then another book called Compassion and Emptiness in Early Buddhism. So I think those are sort of the sources that he was speaking from.
Yeah. And those were the sources those were the books that we were required to read prior to doing the retreats. The Satipatthana practice guide, which I really enjoyed. I got a lot out of that. Satipatthana, you know, the way he teaches it is it's really, he teaches this as a, these are basically 4 steps, essentially he actually breaks it down into a 7-spoke wheel. And there's 3 spokes in the first foundation of mindfulness, 1 spoke in the second foundation of mindfulness, another spoke in the third foundation of mindfulness, and then 2 spokes on this wheel in the 4th foundation of mindfulness. And it was basically 7 steps of how to arouse the awakening factors in your mind in order to do true insight meditation. And then kind of going back through each of it in a way, being mindful of your body, being mindful of your feelings, your mind, and then of the dhammas that come up. And then just kind of going through that, and then it all culminates in his 4 themes of awakening, which is, you know, seclusion from the hindrances, dispassionate, allowing things to end, cessation, and then letting go. And that's enough to get to stream entry, you know, by arousing the awakening factors and going through insight with those themes. You know, he says that's enough to get to stream entry by doing just the Satipatthana. You can do that. And then with the Anapanasati, the same type of thing. It was all the first 12 contemplations in the Anapanasati, which is it's basically the first three the first three sets of four is what it is. Mind, body, body, feelings, and mind. That was all meant to arouse the awakening factors. And then on the, in the last four, you're developing insight by working with the themes of awakening. And then with this most recent one, this was on the Brahma Viharas and emptiness. And, with this, it was again a 10-day. It was technically really only nine nights, I suppose. But just to kind of with this one for me personally, it was harder at first because there was nothing romantic about this for me. I didn't go anywhere to a cabin. I didn't have any kind of beautiful scenery. I was in the mundane, you know, my boring house and just me. And I gave my phone to somebody, and I had an old phone that had Zoom on it that I used to connect to the Zoom and watch the content, and that was it. So it started off kind of tough. The first day, there wasn't a discussion. He just released content for the first day, which was just on the meditation. And the first meditation was we just work on arousing the Brahma Viharas. And in his style of arousing the Brahma Viharas, he goes into the language of what Brahma Vihara means. And it means the resting place of gods, or resting place of God, or it's divine abiding. Is like the literal translation, but resting place of God. And so these are four mental attitudes in which to rest. And we work on arousing these attitudes and just resting in them. And his whole thing is with each Brahma Vihara, instead of, you know, doing it, it's all about relaxing into it. So it's just one short phrase or one image or one feeling to catch the essence of each Brahma Vihara. So with metta, you know, sometimes you can just say metta, and that can kind of bring you that essence. And then you're mindful of that feeling, and you try to relax into it, allow it to kind of grow through your body. And as it grows, you then sort of relax. He has you envision like a curtain in front of you, and you relax in a way that this curtain gets opened, and then you do it to your side, to your back, to your other side, above and below. And so you send off, you basically relax the metta into each direction. And that's really all we worked on for the first day. The second day, we built on that by doing the same thing with each Brahma Vihara, but then being mindful of the awakening factors within each Brahma Vihara. So with metta, we relaxed into metta, sent it off into the different directions, and then we became mindful of the state. And we started by investigating, but he went with a different order. So we started off by investigating. And then after investigating, we asked for, and in metta specifically, we ask, is there any ill will or aversion? And once we find, you know, there is no ill will or aversion in this perfect attitude of metta, we arouse equipoise. And then after equipoise is aroused, we arouse energy. And then with energy, we arouse tranquility. And then from there, we get joy. And then from joy, we get into concentration. or unification of mind, samadhi. And you do that for each of the Brahma Viharas.
So just for those who don't know, what Will just described are the seven awakening factors, although you didn't explicitly mention mindfulness, which is the first of them, but that's sort of assumed.
That's
what the awakening factors are in relationship to loving kindness.
Yeah, that's like the that's the arrangement of them. Yeah, exactly. But yeah, mindfulness is the foundation of the practice. So we start off by being mindful of the Brahma Vihara, and then with mindfulness we investigate, and then we go from there. Now the third day was when we got into the actual emptiness. We started to get into emptiness. And so going through the Brahma Viharas, when you arouse the state of equipoise, or sorry, of equanimity, of upekkha, which is the last of the Brahma Viharas, it's the balancing of the Brahma Viharas, and you rest in this peace of equanimity, that's a very easy time to switch your objects from the space that you're sending out the divine abiding and the attitude. You basically swap them from your main object from being, it was the equanimity. You make your main object the space, and you make the equanimity in your peripheral awareness of that. So it's kind of like your secondary object. Almost like keeping your breath in your periphery while you have another object.
So you and I talked earlier this week about that. Can you elaborate more on what he means by space? Because people can mistake that means spaciness.
I'm sorry, you broke up there, Peter.
Well. You and I talked earlier this week, and can you elaborate more on what he means by space? Because people could think that means spaciness.
Right. Yeah. So by space, so when I was talking earlier about how when we relax into the Brahma Vihara and we send it out, there's a sense, a perception of openness to that sending out. That's why they kind of do that. That image with loving kindness practices. They send it to the different directions to all beings, right? And what that does is it creates an openness, an open type of perception, right? And the way I experience it, at first when I experienced it, it was more just like a perception of openness, you know, like an idea, a concept. But now it's experienced for me a little bit more directly, where it's hearing silence in noise or sound, hearing the silence underneath sound, hearing basically seeing the space between objects. Everything is, you know, there's space everywhere. Pretty much everything is space. Even all matter is primarily space. And that's kind of how conceptually he breaks it down at first. Like there's space. And if you talk to someone who's a physics person, they would tell you everything is basically space. It's just like everything's just moving so fast you can't tell, right? So that's conceptually what he's talking about. But experientially for me, it's more like just a quietness. It's basically the gap between senses of any sense. It's that quiet period between a thought or a feeling or whatever. That's what space is for me. So that becomes your object in that fifth level there, where that becomes your object, and your secondary object is the equanimity in your peripheral awareness. And then you investigate into space with mindfulness, mindful of the space, you investigate into it. You arouse the equipoise, you arouse the energy, you arouse the tranquility, the very subtle joy at that level, and then concentration, the unification of mind within that space. And you rest there in that space. And it's pretty cool. You know, it was tough to do. It was a lot of efforting it for me at first, you know, but, you know, we keep kind of building on it. And so the sixth day from space, we move then into infinite consciousness, where conceptually what he's talking about is using this just as a meditation tool, not reality, but just as a meditation tool, realizing that all this space is really just in your mind. And so your consciousness is just infinite. And so this space is really just infinite consciousness. It's all just in your mind anyways. And so, you know, you do the different directions, or that you do the directions, infinite consciousness in front, to the side, the back, to the other side, above, below, and then through the body. It's all just in your mind, and so then you rest.
That's synonymous with emptiness, right? The space is synonymous with emptiness. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I mean it's like the first level of emptiness. Yeah, it's like the first level of emptiness, and then getting down into the mind. That's the second level of the emptiness, according to him. You know, that at least that's how he breaks it down. But then he takes it a third level, where within the mind now there is a self. And so this next level is called nothingness. And so this is where we drop the concept of self. And for me, that was more just like the space, kind of within the space. It was like where things were happening, but there wasn't I just kind of rested, and I guess me and Peter talked about this, kind of became dispassionate towards thoughts of self. You know, it was more just like just kind of resting in everything that wasn't self at that point. And so you do that in, he actually doesn't do the directions with that, but you just kind of rest in that concept. So resting in that concept, and then trying to experience it, you arouse the awakening factors. So in this, mindful of it, you go through that same order. And then that was pretty cool. And with each of these levels now, you can bring this into your daily life. This is all stuff that you can kind of you can notice the space in life. You can notice everything being in your infinite consciousness, like during your day to day. And then you can also take yourself out of situations. You can see where, you know, there's any kind of conceit in situations. So getting that that dispassion. Like developing dispassion towards these attachments, that can be used in your daily life in a lot of great ways. Now,
you use the word conceit. Can you say more about what you mean by conceit?
Like conceptualizing, making things me, mine, I, me. Yeah. Or just being conceited, you know, that's probably not good either.
Word conceit in English basically comes from imagination, something that is imagined. A conceit is something that's imagined, and that's what the self is. It's imagined.
I'm not sure, but is conceptualized part of that same root of conceit? I'm not sure. Is that part of it?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. That's what I thought. I wasn't sure. So the fourth level of this, now we get into what is called nimittas. And a nimitta is like a sign. The last level is called signlessness. And he gave a very ordinary example of a nimitta. Even though the mind is constantly doing nimittas, every time you see anything, your mind is doing nimittas just to basically process, just to process reality. It's just it's an evolutionary mechanism of the mind that you just kind of point to signs because it's easier than having to process something fully. You can kind of skip things, seeing the sign of something and saying, oh, that's what that is. But so he gave a very ordinary example. And the example is he just started drawing on a piece of paper. And he's like, so I'm going to draw this piece of paper. And once your mind, like, watch your mind while I draw this on this paper. And once your mind goes, oh, he's drawing this, that's the nimitta. And so he's drawing it. And, you know, I'm watching my mind. And then I catch it. It says, oh, he's drawing a car. And sorry about that.
As soon as he starts to draw, the mind, the nimitta is that's a line. He doesn't even have to draw a car. He can just simply, as soon as you recognize it and identify it and label it as a line, that's the nimitta, and that leads right into papancha, which is the way the mind creates a sense of self around a seed, a nimitta.
Yeah, and that's kind of that's like the nimitta last is like the almost like the last, really like the first starting point of the mind, right? The nimitta is the first part of conceptualizing. That's the first stage of conceptualizing, is the nimitta. With getting into infinite consciousness, we kind of break down the papancha by turning our attention away from the rest of the pancha, or the rest of the five aggregates, and we're basically turning the mind on consciousness. We're directing our attention towards consciousness instead of the aggregates. I think I got that right.
Yeah, but, you're talking about the emptiness is about the mind rather than the other aggregates.
Right. Like that's exactly right. Yeah, we're turning our attention to consciousness and rather than our the other aggregates, not feelings, not volition, not ideas. I'm not sure what the other one is.
Feelings. But,
feelings, ideas, volitions, form. Attention. And then what's the other one?
Five aggregates are form, feelings, fabrications. Damn, I'm going blank now too. Huh? Wow, that's weird.
So it's feelings,
perceptions, forms, feelings, perceptions, mental fabrications in consciousness. Those are the five aggregates.
Okay. Yeah, that's right. So basically, we're turning consciousness towards consciousness. What we're doing with this, with the mind specifically, So on this last one, the task is to, after having aroused the Brahmaviharas, after having kind of broken down our concept of self now we're watching the mind so closely, we're developing dispassion towards nimittas in the mind. And so we're turning our consciousness away from the nimitta. And so every time that the nimitta starts to form, we then purposely turn our attention away from it. And at this stage, you really can't think or process anything without a nimitta. So after you've done all the other levels and you start to turn towards, it's called non-nimitta, which means signlessness, once we do this process of non-nimitta, we then are basically in a state of, it's like real, like whiteness, you know, that's real blankness.
But when we talked earlier, Will, you said there was a point at which you got scared. And I think you're in that zone right now. Can you talk about that for a bit?
Yeah, we're getting there. So, so after we get to the signlessness part, Anallio brings up that there's one last part of signlessness. There's basically, you can go beyond this. And he gave a warning out. He said, you can go beyond this, but if you do this, you're going to incline your mind towards Nibbana. You're going to incline your mind towards towards liberation. And so if you've taken the Bodhisattva vow, which is where you've vowed to hold off becoming enlightened until all beings have become enlightened first, then you should not take this step because it's not going to give you enough lifetimes to practice. It's not going to give you enough to become a full Buddha. But if you're okay with just liberation, then this is the then you know, go ahead and do this. But you know, he said, even if you didn't take the Bodhisattva vow, you should still think hard about this, whether or not you'd actually want to become liberated. And so I'm like, well, dang, you know, why wouldn't I? I guess that was, you know, it's funny because you don't, when you do this practice, a lot of times you have to look at what your intention is. And my intention is to be happy and to help people in my life and to, you know, to be at peace. But I don't know what this whole liberation thing really means. What does it all entail, right? And so I had to deal with my own attachments, right, at that point. What am I holding on to and what am I clinging to here? But with that being said, needless to say, the way he taught this was within each of these mind states, within each of these levels of the Brahma Viharas and then getting into the different levels of emptiness, is there is a weariness to each level. There's a tension behind each level that we have become mindful of.
That's dukkha. That's dukkha.
Exactly. It's and as we go down each level, even in space, there's weariness, there's tension in space. We let go of that tension, and then we get into infinite consciousness. And within infinite consciousness, there's the tension of the I, and we let go of that, and then we get into nothingness, which is where there's no self, non-self. And then there's still tension of non-self. And by letting go of the tension of non-self, we get into the non-nimitta, right? And the non-nimitta is that kind of last stage. But he said, now if you're inclined to achieve enlightenment or not enlightenment, but nibbana, then same thing, enlightenment, I guess in our translation. But if you want to attain nibbana, then there's one last level, and that is basically, notice, be mindful of the tension within non-nimitta, and then allow anicca to basically allow that to change, allow that to pass. Be mindful of anicca within the tension of non-nimitta. And I mean, needless to say, when I got to non-nimitta, I became mindful of the anicca, whether I wanted it or not. It just happened. I did it on accident. And I don't know. I don't know what that means, but it freaked me out. And,
yeah, me too. It happened to me many years ago. It freaked me out too. It's like trying to walk on ice. You can't get any traction about there being a self. When you have a pure awareness of anicca, it just reveals that there really isn't any enduring self. It just isn't there.
Yeah, you see something you can't unsee. That's for sure. And it was, but the feeling was very high energy, very, like, the feeling tone was very high energy. It was very pleasant, but I can't say that, like, it was dispassionate. I'm dispassionate towards it. I'm not trying to chase that. You know, I'm more interested in the Brahma Viharas because that's what's going to give me the positive mental states that I want, the positive mind states. Like I'm more interested in peace of mind is really where my interest is. And for me, that's a growth for me. And I think that a lot of that has to do with the work that I've done with not only the Buddhist meditation, with I think also with AA as well, with the 12 steps I've done and everything that's helped.
And we just did that 8-week series on the four Brahma Viharas too.
Okay. Yeah.
Which I think that, probably yeah. part of it.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, we did with Sharon Salzberg. Yeah, that was a great. I'm glad I did that too, because that kind of kicked me off. And my life was just going great, or just I was feeling really good doing that. So I kept practicing, I kept going. After that point, that was kind of like that was my most exciting meditation experience. From there, really, I was just refining the relaxation and mindfulness of the Brahma Viharas, and then those first levels of emptiness, because you can really rest in that space, and then the infinite consciousness, and then also the no self is definitely something that's helpful. I'm not too good about that. I still have quite a bit of conceit, which I'm, you know, I with time I hope to work on that too. We're chipping away at it here, I guess, the enduring self, the concept of it. There's one other thing. Oh yeah. But with space, I find that to be one of my greatest tools today, right now afterwards. And then kind of the retreat after the retreat is I'm noticing I'm much more mindful of space. And that's just like, it's just a much more open quality to my attention. And it adds a whole different level of what I'm mindful of. I can always kind of
what does that bring to your daily life experience? In other words, when you're going through your day, how does this awareness of space benefit you? Can you talk about the subjective experience?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I can make it real simple. If I just want to use a few words, it makes it easy for me to let go, because there's always just that space. There's always the end point of all phenomena. Even right now, I see the video of myself on the Zoom call, but I know that's not me. That's just an image, and I'm aware of the space. I'm aware of that even what I see in front of me, what I perceive as myself right now, not the image aside, but just seeing my hand move and seeing like the tip of my nose. I know none of this is like, I have a more clear awareness of this not really being like, you know, it's not like concrete. I'm not as attached to it. I'm still attached to it.
Unless
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the viraga. That's the dispassion.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not. Yeah, exactly. There's a new level of dispassion. And also kind of a courage to explore some other like areas of attachment that I do have. And so I'm kind of excited, and I have some willingness and courage to, maybe play with some of my other attachments and maybe start just experimenting with things, changing some things for the better that are going to make, you know, the world, or just make the world, people in my life and my life just better. And that's kind of cool. Like one thing I did is I raised my thermostat 4 degrees, just because I keep it pretty low in the house, and I figured, you know, I'm gonna keep my thermostat 4 degrees higher, and let's just see what happens. And I don't know, it's like an experiment, and there's something I normally would have been afraid to try even, but I'm like, you know, I'm just gonna do it, because it's good for the environment, and it's an act of kindness. It's gonna be easier on my electric bill. It's going to be better, you know? So let's just try it out. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. Well, you can always turn it back down a little bit, you know, or turn it maybe 2 degrees back down, you know, and find a compromise. But I don't know, right now it's working out. So that's just one example. I found a lot of courage and willingness lately.
That's the letting go part.
Letting go, exactly. Yeah.
Let go and let God, right?
That's it. That's it. Or let the, I guess, the God's abiding.
Yeah, let go and let Dharma.
Yeah, let Dharma. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So thank you for that, Will. That's very insightful and rewarding for me. I mean, it really helps me to connect the dots more. So the floor is now open for people to make comments or ask questions of you about what you've told us. Any questions or comments?
I do.
All right. Mindy is here in the room. Okay, go ahead, Mindy. Take your mask off so you can talk louder.
Okay. So thank you for...
You hear her?
Yep, I hear.
Okay, go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for sharing your experience. Tonight it was very interesting. I liked it was intriguing to me what you had to say when you were talking about, you know, like how everything is just space, and like even like your hand in front of you is just, you know, space, but then really like it's in consciousness, it's just space. Like there's not really, like when you were talking about nothing, you know, it just made me think of no thing, you know, there's just no thing. Which to me is very liberating, especially, you know, just in life in general, human experience of life in general, to be aware of space and no thing. It is like a letting go. It helps me anyways. I don't know. It helps me be aware of creation, I guess, is the closest word that I can to describe what it brings to, you know, my spirit, just to create. There's no thing, it's all space. I don't know. I really enjoyed your insight that you took away from your retreat that you just did with Analeo, which I know I've heard that name before, but I feel pretty ignorant not knowing exactly who he is. But I heard that he does have books, and I am going to read them because it is very, very interesting to me. And, you know, I was acutely, very keenly focused on what you were saying, and that doesn't happen all the time. So anyways, thank you so much for your share.
See, you're inspiring, Will. Well done, sir.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks. All right.
Robert? Bob?
Will, could you describe how the retreat was structured? Like, what time did you start? How did the day go? What time did you start? That kind of stuff.
Yeah. So it wasn't like super highly structured. It was my retreat. So I sort of just had some simple rules that I followed every day. And obviously it was basically no big meals after noon. 45 minute meditations, formal mm-hmm. sitting meditations a day, at least 45 minutes, at least six of those every day, no matter what. And then there was a discussion every day at 10:30 a.m. And then content was released at 11:30. And so for me, the way I normally did it every day is I woke up around, you know, 5 or 6. I meditated, or I drank my coffee, kind of woke up. And then I meditated for about 45 minutes or longer. And then, you know, usually 45 minutes. And then I would eat breakfast, all vegetarian. And then after breakfast, I'd go walk my dog. Mm-hmm. I discovered a park pretty close by to my house. I lived here for 3 years and I found a park after being here for 3 years. And so I went to the park with my dog for a little bit after that. Then I went back and sat again. And then, after a 45 minute sit, I would do the discussion. And then I would usually, you know, maybe clean up a little bit or shower. And then I'd eat lunch just before noon or at. And then I would meditate again around 2 o'clock. And then I'd do a little walk maybe after that for 45 minutes, do walking meditation for 45 minutes or do cleaning meditation. I would clean just because that was a nice activity. It was a nice thing to do for myself for when I got out of the retreat. It'd be nice to have a really clean house. I figured yeah. some loving kindness towards myself, but also it was a good way to just do a mindful activity, do something active. And then after that, I sat again. And then by then, I would have had my four sits in, like major sits in for the day. And then by 5 o'clock, I would have like a, you know, like a protein shake. And then I'd sit again at 6:30. I go for a long walk with my dog. And then at 8:30, 8:45, I'd have one last sit. I would then have some chamomile tea. And then I'd go to bed by 10. I'd do the same thing over again.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Other questions or comments?
I did want to bring one thing, Peter, if that's all right.
Wait. Yeah, and then Steve. Go ahead. And then Steve. Go ahead, Will.
Okay, yeah. It got the conversations got really interesting on the Q&A after Analio gave out that warning about the liberation or becoming, you know, getting Nirvana. A lot of the conversation in the Q&A got really interesting, and they started asking him. A lot of people started asking questions about, you know, like rebirth and stuff with like what the early Buddhist perspective is on rebirth. And, you know, he actually wrote a book on it. He wrote a book on rebirth, and he had some interesting things to say. And there's some science behind it. And he said that it's like when the quote he used is, he said that consciousness is like a fire, like a forest fire. When a tree is burning up, the wind can carry fire from another tree to a tree that isn't burning without any fuel. And it can just do this. The wind can just carry the fire over to another tree without any type of fuel. And he said that consciousness is kind of like the same thing. And the thing that carries it over is clinging, is our clinging is what he says causes rebirth for us. And even though we, you know, and there's, you know, he said it's quite common for people between the ages of 4, 5, and 6 to have recollections of past lives. But after that, it's not really possible. Before that, after that, it's not really possible. Between the ages of 4, 5, and 6, it's common for people to have recollections of past lives. And So I really want to see if my son has any recollections of that, because he's right at that. He's at that last. He's at the twilight of that that period. Yeah,
that's the premise upon which the choice of the next Dalai Lama is founded. That's why they pick a child who's what we would call a preschooler, and give them certain objects that are related to the prior Dalai Lama. And if the child can recognize those objects, you know, like might put three pairs of glasses down, you know, eyeglasses, and one of them used to belong to the other Dalai Lama. So the next Dalai Lama will pick the correct pair of eyeglasses. Okay, so Steve, you have a question or a comment, sir?
It will go away.
Oh, where is he?
Oh, well.
He'll be back.
But was there a name to this retreat course? I mean, he did it himself. I get it at his house, but was this also guided meditations in addition to in, you know, with a group?
I'm not sure. I know that it was promoted by the Berry Center for Buddhist Studies, which is up in Massachusetts. So that's what I would say about that. Let me text Will, see what's up.
He's off in space.
I'm texting him. Where are you? In emptiness? See what that gets. While we're waiting for him, let me just make a couple of comments. First of all, one of the reasons why we do this is I want people to be inspired to go on retreats. Here he is. So, were you in emptiness, Will?
Yes, I was in infinite space there.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, Steve, ask your question, sir.
All right. So, the space grabbed you again.
Yeah.
Or you grabbed the space.
Yeah.
I know you did this at your house, but was this a retreat that was conducted at this specific time with a combination of guided meditations and also a connection with a group? Is that how that worked for you?
Yeah. So there was always like a meditation hall open, but there wasn't any like guided meditations within the hall, but it was like a virtual meditation hall on Zoom that you could just kind of join in if you wanted to. I never did. And there was also a discussion forum for the retreat on Canvas, which is where it's the platform that they used to release the content. And they released content every day for the first 6 days. And each day included one guided meditation and then one lecture video.
So they have what was the name of this program then? This is online. It must be on one of the sites.
Yeah. So this was through the Berry Center for Buddhist Studies, which is it's bcbs.org. And they hold several of these types of retreats, Zoom retreats or home retreats. They have several like every month or so, I think. I mean, as far as I know, and so does the Insight Meditation Society. I believe they're still doing Zoom retreats too, along with Spirit Rock. They're all of those are, they're doing these Zoom retreats. So, you know, they're pretty cool. They're not very, it's cheaper than a residential retreat. It was only, I think I did the base level of 170 to do the retreat.
Went up there for the previous retreats, right? You went to BCBS.
I didn't go to BCBS. I ended up getting a cabin at San Pedro Center one time. Right. And then I also got a cabin out in Dahlonega, Georgia for the mindfulness of breathing. And then for this one, I stayed home.
Yeah, but I think this series was something that was, I don't know that he's going to do it again.
He will do it again.
Really? After his 1 year sabbatical?
Yeah. If he, you know, assuming he's still alive in a year, but I mean, you know, I imagine he will be, right? But I mean, with.
Oh, yeah. I think he's probably in his 50s, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, he's very young, but I'm just saying you never know, right? And right. God willing, after he's done with his retreat, he's going to do it again. He's going to start the series up again sometime in November of 2023. So I'm looking forward to it. I'll do it again. I recommend doing it. It's given me a really strong foundation and a lot of knowledge about like authentic, like Buddhism, like about, cause there's so much, it's so, there's so many different teachings and there's so many different people touting themselves as Buddhist. And it's, a lot of it isn't, you know, a lot of it is cultural or it's just got a lot more to it than what was taught by the Buddha. This is just very, I just trust it. That's the way to put it. I trust it.
Yeah. I have read the Satipatthana, book and the workbook, the Satipatthana, practice guide and the Anapanasati book. I haven't really read through the Compassion and Emptiness book yet. I think the Anapanasati book has been a really important resource for me with my practice. I used it as a guide in my last self-retreat. Other questions or comments?
I have a question.
All right, Mindy?
Is there a book of his that you would recommend for somebody who's very green, you know, to start with?
Basic.
is there a basic text for him?
Foundation book, yeah.
That would be tough because his books are very much annotated. There's a lot of he's a very profound scholar as well as a meditation teacher. So I don't know.
They're extremely academic books.
Yeah.
They're extremely academic. There's no.
Well, then Satipatthana, The Direct Path to Realization.
That'd be the best place to start. I think that honestly, if you're just trying to get on the cushion and you're looking for something to like, you know.
I've been on the cushion.
Well, but I mean, if you're looking to like change your meditation and really see how he meditates differently, I think the practice guide is, I mean, I enjoyed it better than the Sati. I mean, it's tough for me to read a Dalio. It's not fun reading. It's not relaxing reading. Like, it's not like reading Sharon Salzberg or Jack Kornfield or Joseph Goldstein or something like that. It's just very academic.
So which one did you just
say? The Satipatthana practice guide. But the Anapanasati book is also really good too.
And that's also a practice guide too. The Anapanasati
book. Yeah, I think it's just the title of it is just Anapanasati. But if you go to Amazon and you inquire about Anaglio, then you see the listing of his books. He's got a lot of books.
He he has a lot of books. Yeah, he does. And a lot of them are out of publications, so you can just download them for free.
Yeah, that's true, too. You can get a PDF probably of them. Email me. If anybody wants to email me, I probably have the PDF version in my computer somewhere, and I can just forward it to you. Other questions or comments? Oh my God. Yeah, William?
Yeah, I just want to say I really enjoyed that. It's very inspiring, the Will's talk. So I just want to let him know that. And I'm very happy. It sounds like it really helped him a lot. So that's it.
All right. So we're pretty much out of time now. I just, like I started to say, we're dwelling in emptiness for a moment there, Will. We're having a one-week retreat. It's an annual thing we've been doing for probably 10 or 12 years now at Deerhaven, which is north of us in Lake County. It's not that far away. And that will be it starts at the end of October and goes on into November of this year. Let me see here. Yeah, it starts the 29th of October and ends on the 5th of November. And then in February, beginning of February, February 3rd through the 10th, we'll be having producing a retreat at the San Pedro Center, which is about a mile or two from my house. And we have a guest teacher who is also a very respected teacher and scholar, Shyla Catherine. So that will be happening.
She works very closely with Analia.
Yes, she does. Yes, she. In fact, if you get his books, you'll see that she writes one of the you ought to read this book blurbs that's usually in the front of a book. So also, I want to announce that I'm recruiting people for the next intensive study group, which hopefully there'll be enough people to commit to it to start at the end of this month. But it's going to be themed around a book called 8 Mindful Steps to Happiness by Gunaratana. It's a really good book. It's easier to read than Analio, but Gunaratana is also a very respected scholar and meditator and teacher. So if you are interested in that, it's 8-week series. And it will be on Saturday afternoons from 3 to 4:30. There's still a couple of spots left in the Sunday afternoon group from 3 to 4:30 via Zoom. And asking for a donation of $160 to the Orlando Insight Meditation Group, which is a nonprofit corporation. That's not required, but it's requested. And as soon as there's enough people, I will be sending a curriculum, I guess you would say, and asking people to meditate for 45 minutes a day during that 8 weeks. So there's that. And the topic for next week's, I'm going to start out with a review of, you're going to love this mouthful, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, which is translated as the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. The Great Turning of the Wheel of Dharma. Supposedly the first talk that was given by the Buddha. But I've been doing a lot of research on the history of it. Will was talking about Analio saying that it's not real certain exactly what how accurate that discourse is in terms of what the Buddha actually taught in his lifetime. That's why Analio compared the suttas and the agamas. The agamas were from China. So I'm going to be talking about that overview of the Four Noble Truths, and then I'm going to after that start to go through the first of the four, then the second, the third, and the fourth systematically. And of course, the fourth one is the Noble Eightfold Path. So I'm going to be revisiting these. I've taught this before on Wednesday nights, but each time I do it, there's a kind of a different perspective that comes from my studies and my meditation practice. So if you're interested in that, tune in next Wednesday night. So thank you very much, Will, for your practice and your commitment.
My pleasure. Real quick, can I put a plug in for you, Peter?
What's that?
I just wanted to say that, for anyone who hasn't done it before, that the Deerhaven Retreat, that's probably my favorite retreat. Like, I'm going to make sure that I do that one every year, no matter what. So I did that one earlier this year, or last year, rather, in October. And I just want to put that out there for everybody. So if you guys want to do a good retreat, that's a really fun one. It's great to do it around people that you know, with Peter being the teacher. And then the food there is just amazing. It's just the staff and everything. The accommodations are just really comfortable. And just want to put that out there for you guys. And San Pedro Center is also beautiful, beautiful place.
Yes. Yeah. All right. So as is our custom, let's sit for a moment. Thank you for your practice. I wish you well. Hope you all stay reasonably safe and happy till the next time we talk. And if you're interested in the study group, just send me an email, peter@orlandoinsightmeditation.org. Let me know of your interest, and we'll move forward.